The following is an interview with Sam Kennett Cecil by Mary Height for the Kentucky Oral History Commission, studying prohibition in Nelson County, its causes and effects. The interview was conducted in Nelson County, Bardstown area, at Springfield Road on May the 5th, 1989. Mr. Cecil, could you give us a little update on your background, where you were born, and a little bit about your family, your parents, and so forth, please?
I was born on Maple Hill in 1918, which was just prior to beginning of Prohibition, and my father bought a lot off the old Davy Woods farm, which was the first lot that was taken from his farm. I think he bought that lot about 1914, but he was right adjacent to the old F.G. Walker distillery. In fact, the office of the distillery later became a residence, and quite a number of years later became an old grocery store. But all those buildings are gone now. In fact, the jail sits on my old home place. I attended school at Bethlehem Academy for 8 years, and then I went to St. Joe Prep for my 4 years in high school. Shortly after high school, I joined the T.W. Samuels Distillery as a laboratory technician, and later on I studied chemistry at the University of Louisville and also physics, and I continued in the chemistry field until I, of course, entered service in January 1941. Nearly a year before war was declared. I spent 5 years on active duty during World War II. Immediately after I returned from service, I joined Heaven Hill Distillery in December 1945. I stayed with Heaven Hill until December 1952, and I was their chief chemist there for that period of time, and I handled all the quality control work in the warehouse and bottling operation, and also did a considerable amount of work with their boiler plant, preventing scale corrosion in their boilers, but also did a lot of control work in the distillery itself. After I left Heaven Hill, I joined the Dance Distillery at Gethsemane, and I worked alternately between the Dance Station plant, which was number 169, and the Gethsemane plant, number 47. I went to work there when Armin Hammer owned the plant. But very short time after I joined the Dance Distillery, Hammer sold out to Shanley. While I was working for Hammer, I was really running a bottling house, which is a job I didn't particularly relish, because bottling houses are pretty tough jobs. Shortly after Shanley bought the plant in the spring of 1953, they found out that my background had been in the chemistry field and quality control, so they immediately asked me to set up a laboratory, which I ran for somewhat over a year. In fact, it was spring of 1954 that the Dant Distillery, under Shanley Operations, ceased operation, or at least suspended it for a short period, and they laid everyone off. And I think I had about enough with a very small plant operation, and I decided that I just as soon change. And in the meantime, Bill Samuels had offered me a job at what was then the old Samuels Distillery at Loretta, the old Samuel Stereo, he had bought some period before that, and he had just started operations at the plant. That plant was ultimately, well, beginning, it was the old Burke Spring Distillery, later changed to Happy Hollow. And he had asked me to come to work for him, so I immediately went down to Loretta to work for Bill at the old Samuel Distillery. Now, that distillery later, of course, was changed to Star Hill, and then right now it's the Maker's Mark Distillery. I stayed there from the 1st of April 1954 until December 1980 when I retired. Cut that off.
Was your father involved or your family involved in the distilling business in any way?
Nelson County has been so well known for whiskey production, and about the only thing available for, as far as employment was concerned, Nelson County was whiskey business. While my father had worked in the whiskey business, he was one of the old-time cutters. Worked for a number of distilleries before Prohibition. Of course, he died before Prohibition was repealed. He died in 1932. He had worked for Roll Mattingly Moore and I think Tom Moore, which were adjacent plants. And he worked for the OFG Walker Distillery, which was right next door to us. But he did not have a long period. Of course, he was very young when he died. He was only 49 years old. But I was offered this job at T.W. Samuels in 1937, and as I say, I worked there until January 1941, and I became very much interested in whiskey business. It presented quite a challenge to me because I was in an area where I could really study and learn all the various departments of the operation. I not only worked with the distillery, but I worked with warehousing and I worked with bottling, and it became quite a fascinating thing to see all the different phases of the operation, how they tied in the operation in the distillery from production of the new whiskey, then following it through its aging process, then finally into bottling. And you learn something new every day in dealing with all the different phases of the operation. Actually, after the war, I was a little concerned about what I was going to get back into because I had been working with the ordnance department, and which concern mostly maintenance of equipment, tanks, guns, all types of weapons. And I really hadn't thought that maybe I forgot all I knew about the whiskey business, having been gone for 5 years and only being associated with the distillery for over 3 years before the war. But Charlie Spain offered me a job at Heaven Hill, which included setting up a laboratory from the very beginning. He had nothing there at the time. And he asked me to come out and set up a laboratory for him. And I decided after much deliberation I would go ahead and do it. And after that period, why, I guess I was hooked.
Hooked, that's right.
I felt like, well, this is about it. I might as well devote my whole life to working in whiskey business. And of course, I had worked at Heaven Hill for 7 years and gained considerable background there, and then began to follow right on through. And after that, why I was offered these other jobs, and I learned quite a bit about it in the process, particularly by changing from to different operations. Everybody has different ideas about right. whiskey business, and I learned a little bit from all of them,
mm-hmm.
some good, some bad.
Mm-hmm.
And fortunately, I was able to separate the good from the bad, and I think that the experience helped me tremendously when I took over the management of Maker's Mark.
It's a fascinating career, really.
It really is. I felt like it. It's one of the most interesting businesses that you could enter.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, when I joined Maker's Mark, it was such a very small operation that you had to wear so many different hats that no 2 days were ever alike. And while we were strictly engaged in the business of producing whiskey for the first 4 years or so, I was strictly running the distillery end of it and the warehousing. But then later on, I got into bottling. And of course, there was always the administration. And then when we did start bottling, securing all the permits and learning the state requirements and securing bonds and all those things, why it developed further. And then of course in the shipping area, why I took that over too, and it gradually evolved into quite a varied activity. But I was in charge of the operation ever. Of course, Elmo Beam was our distiller for the first year that I went to Maker's Mark, but unfortunately Elmo died and I had to take over the whole plant. And I remained in that until, in fact, I spent about 26, almost 27 years at Maker's Mark.
So outside of the wartime, you were involved in it for?
All my life.
All your life.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Up to now.
How long have you been retired?
I'm not through yet. I've been retired since December 1980. It's going on 9 years.
Quite a long time for you.
Actually, it meant that I spent about 40 some odd years less my wartime service. And I guess that's long enough.
Quite long, I'd say. So, Mr. Cecil, you were virtually a baby when the Prohibition came into being.
Oh, yes,
so,
I don't remember anything
so
about the
enactment mm-hmm.
of the
mm-hmm.
18th Amendment when Prohibition came in. I heard a lot of talk about it over those years. And, of course, living right next door to a distillery, we heard a little bit more than maybe some others, because I've seen some warehouses go up in flames.
Is that right?
Yeah, when I was very, very small, I can remember standing at the back window of our house and looking out over the field there, all the warehouses going up. And apparently what happened is the whiskey was stolen and the warehouse burned down to cover the theft.
Was that quite prevalent?
I think that happened in a number of cases, but of course some of the warehouses were, the whiskey was taken out and shipped into Louisville, and a lot of whiskey was bottled at the old Louisville Public Warehouse. But a lot of whiskey was stolen, yes.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, we had a tenant on the farm over at Loretta, the Maker's Mark plant, the name of Bill Shockensey. And Shockensey died back in the late 60s, I think it was. And he was about fellow then, but he remembered quite well when Prohibition came in. In fact, he lived on that farm his entire life, and he was a tenant for the farm while I was operating the plant. And old Shock told me that sometime after Prohibition was repealed, a very notorious character by the name of Ramos came in there, and he was living on the back side of the farm at the time. I think he'd already been married and probably had some children. But Ramos and his crew paid him some money to get lost while they broke into the warehouses and took the whiskey. But he was, of course, not really involved because he was not hired as a watchman or caretaker of any kind. He was strictly a tenant farmer. And he didn't know what they were going to do. They just gave him some money and told him to get out of the way. And of course, that was probably the wise thing to do because they were really dangerous characters. He, Ramos, was, he wasn't in the Al Capone class because Al Capone strictly dealt in beer, as I understand it. But Ramos was headquartered around Erlanger. And I think his principal mission after Prohibition was repealed was to go around and pick up whatever whiskey could, and he probably dealt a lot of moonshine and bootleg whiskey too, bootlegging it himself. I don't know whatever happened to Ramos.
Was this his last name?
Uh-huh. Yeah, I forget what his first name was. I've heard a lot about his name, but really never knew that much about him.
You mentioned something about public warehousing. The whiskey was taken to the public warehouse. Can you
see,
explain that?
When Prohibition was repealed, when it was enacted, the owners did not lose the ownership of the whiskey. It was decided that whiskey could be sold through drugstores for medicinal purposes. And the Old American Distilling Company assumed the name of American Medicinal Spirits, and Lowell Public Warehouse did the same thing. They simply took whiskey in from various proprietors and bottled it under government supervision, and it was distributed to drugstores where you could buy a bottle of whiskey and use it strictly for medicinal purposes. Of course, that was a big blind, but it was bottled in pint size only. I remember hearing my mother refer to whiskey being $20 a quart during Prohibition, which is considerably higher than it is even today, mm-hmm. with all the tremendous inflation, increase in taxes and all that. But I'm sure her figure came from the fact that you go to a doctor and get a prescription, he charged you $5 for the prescription, and then you went to the drugstore and you paid $5 for the pint of whiskey. So that made $20 a quart.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's strictly hearsay, but I remember hearing my mother say that when I was very, very young.
That's comparable to the prescription prices today, I'd say.
Right, yeah. I accused one old doctor over in Marion County one time of making his living off of whiskey prescription. He kind of laughed. He never denied it.
So these companies, American Medicinal Spirits, and the other one you mentioned, were set up to take whiskey from distillers.
Right, it was in bond, and I think that most of the whiskey was over 4 years old by the time they bottled, so it was bottled in bond.
Mm-hmm.
Because I remember seeing a prescription bottle that Bill Samuels had that he kept over all these years. It was a prescription written by old Dr. Hill right here in Bargetown. It was written on the J. Dan Talbot drugstore, which is now Walgreens. And it was a prescription fill for old man Jim Rouse, Captain Connor's father.
Yeah.
And I think Bill still has that bottle.
Yeah.
It's the only one I've seen in recent years.
Were any of the distilleries in this area allowed to bottle whiskey?
As far as I know, none in Nelson County.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I don't think any of the surrounding counties have had distilleries bottle any whiskey at all.
Mm-hmm. Of course, they weren't allowed to make it, I assume.
No. Mm-hmm. Discontinued operation completely.
Totally. Mm-hmm.
Of course, you know what that meant, as far as particularly Nelson County was so dependent on whiskey production, even though it was a seasonal operation, it provided a tremendous amount of employment. Most of them operated in the wintertime, and it supplied employment for all these farmers in the area. And they would come in and work at the distilleries in the wintertime, and they'd have plenty of time in the spring to do their plowing and planting, and all the way up through the growing season when they were so busy on the farms, they simply tended their farms. Of course, that was pretty much the principle that we used at Maker's Mark when we first started producing, because we didn't know how much we were going to be able to sell. So we limited our production considerably and only operated in the wintertime. And a lot of those fellows in Marion County around Loretta had small farms, and they were quite happy to work at the distillery in the wintertime. I mean, and then go back to their small farms in the summertime. And they thrived quite well. It was an ideal situation for both of us.
Why do you think that Prohibition came in? Was it a feeling that this business was just ruining lives everywhere? Was the temperance movement such a force at that time?
Temperance movement was pretty strong. You take people like Carrie Nation. She, of course, broke up a lot of the saloons in Kansas, and she developed quite a following. And of course, we always say that it was an opportune time for the Anti-Saloon League to come in and enact Prohibition, because it was during World War I, and when all the eligible people who probably would have opposed it were away at war, and it was possible for them, with the backing that they had, to go ahead and get the people to vote Prohibition in. And of course, after the crash of 1929, things became so depressed in all of this area. These people who had been making their livelihood from the distilleries, the farming operations, were bringing absolutely no income. I know farmers who would sell their tobacco in the fall, and the price would not even cover floor charges. I know of many farmers who told me that they'd get a bill after their tobacco was sold, because it just wasn't enough to pay for the handling on the tobacco warehouse floor. And then course, depression left Nelson County particularly long before it did in some other parts of the country, because when Roosevelt came in, that was one of his promises on his platform that he would repeal prohibition. And of course, as you know, it was repealed in 1933, and people went right back to work in Nelson County, where and they had a tremendous amount of employment immediately after prohibition was repealed. Tom Moore, which is now Barton, started back, and of course, since they had particularly T.W. Samuels and Tom Moore, which is now Barton, had resumed operations, and they furnished a tremendous amount of employment. Tom Moore started off very quickly mashing 2,400 bushels, which was a 24-hour operation. T.W. Samuels of Deetsville was mashing 1,864 bushels, which was also a 24-hour operation. And in addition to that, the old Shellhand Distillery started back, which was, I think it first started off as Independent Distillery and later changed to Shellhand. They got started. The old Bardstown Distillery, which later became Glencoe, started operation. The H. McKenna plant at Fairfield. Heaven Hill was built. Although their operation was very small in the beginning, I think they started off with something like 600 bushels. Lambert Willie built a distillery. I think his operation didn't start till about 1938. But still, they furnished a number of jobs for the people in the neighborhood. Beam started back at down in Bullock County. They did not own the plant at Boston at that time. That plant originally started back as they assumed the name of Churchill Downs, but Churchill Downs sued them and they had to change the name to Churchill. And of course that plant was later sold off, and Barton owned it for a period, and I think it was Barton sold it to Beam later on. Of course they have a big operation down there today. The old Limestone Springs plant at Chappies started operating. Now, of course, a number of the old plants that were in existence before Prohibition came in did not reopen. The OFG Walker Distillery never opened. The Sutherland plant never opened. The old Jack Bean plant, which was early times, they never reopened that plant. I can't recall just the Dan Distillery opened under the name of Dan Head. Old man George Dan started his in Marion, in the edge of Marion County, very quickly. The old John A. Watson plant in Lebanon started operation. A lot of the distilleries were, the people still had sufficient funds to get started. Of course, most of them had to seek outside financial help. And as a result of that, most of the owners in the neighborhood lost controlling interest. That thing happened to Tom Moore. Well, man, Con made a lot of money out of it, but he had to sell the controlling interest in his operation. The old Mattingly Moore plant never started back, but now Seagram's owns that brand name today. But they never started operation back after Prohibition. Of course, a lot of you distilleries in Anderson County and Jefferson County and Franklin County, which were big operations for whiskey out business, they started back. Of course, your bigger operations like National Distillers and Sam Bronson's operation came in very shortly after Prohibition. Seagram's plants. And of course, these Chanley. Of course, as time went on, those big plants gobbled up the small ones. And they bought those plants principally during World War II, when whiskey stocks became depleted and they were looking for the bulk whiskey, and they bought the plants to get the whiskey. With the advent of Prohibition, of course, that became quite a moral issue. The various Prohibitionists allied themselves with various churches and were able to outlaw the legal liquor industry. But of course, this has become quite embedded in a number of the religions. Actually, Catholics never have been opposed to it that much, but some of the other religions have. In fact, that's responsible mainly for so many dry counties in the state of Kentucky today. I believe that where some of your Protestant religions are more predominant, we have some 92 counties out of a total of 120 that are legally dry. Now, in what we would term a wet state, that seemed like a tremendous number. But I think the religion factor enters into that considerably. We have a number of precincts, even in some of the wet counties that are dry. In fact, Chaplin, right here in Nelson County, probably the wettest county in the whole state, has been dry ever since I can remember. Some of the counties are dry by local option, but some of the main cities in those counties are wet. And I think religion is a factor. Back here a number of years ago, Warren County went dry. It had been wet for a period of time. Well, the wet forces knew that they couldn't win the county completely, so they petitioned a local option election strictly for Bowling Green and were able to get Bowling Green wet. In Washington County, the same thing happened. Springfield is wet while Washington County is dry. A number of other counties have tried countywide elections, and the wet forces have lost. In fact, one of the most outstanding of those was Bell County. And I happen to know a number of people in Bell County, and they asked me for some help at one time, but I told them I saw no possibility of the county going wet. I said if they petitioned a vote strictly for Middlesboro, I think it would win, but not countywide. Somerset and Pulaski County did the same thing. They petitioned a countywide election and they lost. But that's just the way those counties are bent. That's the way they're going to stay. I don't see any possibility that they'll ever go wet. During Prohibition, in fact, you'll find in some of these dry counties today, a large number of them are very depressed even now. And I think it was a great thing that a lot of the state parks have been built in these depressed areas, because it has furnished a large amount of employment, not only at the parks themselves, but in the industries and the filling stations and the restaurants and other businesses around those communities. But one of the big effects of Prohibition was that I think people felt that the federal government course, voted, it was voted in. The people did it themselves. You can't blame the federal government for something people do. But they forced them out of a legal business that was their only livelihood. This only resulted in them going out and starting to make moonshine. And they felt like, well, I've got to make a living somehow. There was no other means, there was no industry. In fact, it wasn't until a considerable period after World War II that Nelson County was able to attract other industries in. They depended entirely on the whiskey industry to maintain them. And since these people had no means of livelihood, they went out and made moonshine. And they felt like it was their perfect right to do so. I don't think any of them felt any moral guilt in making moonshine. Of course, a lot of it started in some of the more remote sections because they had to get out and hide from the reveners. Because the reveners were pretty strong back during Prohibition, and a lot of them were caught. A lot of people around Nelson County particularly served time for making moonshine. And of course, the moonshine was wholesale to various bootleggers, and the bootleggers operated in bigger towns. And Barstown was loaded with bootleggers at one time. And they, I think the bootleggers didn't have any qualms at all about selling to anybody who came around. Talk about selling to miners these days, the bootlegger didn't mind selling to a miner. He'd sell to a six-year-old kid if he came around for a half pint, if he had the 2 bits to pay for it. Of course, you paid 30 cents if you colored a little red.
Did the local law enforcement, were they along with the reveners, or did they kind of protect their people, or did?
I think the local law enforcement people sort of turned their heads.
Yeah.
And there was very little effort on their part. Now, they had informers around. In fact, I know of one informer, maybe I better not mention his name, who walked hillsides and the streams just to locate these stills, and apparently he must have gotten some kind of a payoff for informing on these moonshiners, but he was, of course, not very well liked. In fact, they despised him, and it's a wonder he hadn't been shot.
Really?
But as far as the local people were concerned, local law enforcement people, they did very little toward helping to find these moonshine stills. In fact, it probably wasn't until after World War II that anybody in the sheriff's department might have ever participated. They, back during, Lud McKay was jailer back during Prohibition, and so was old man Joe Beam. But it's a well-known fact that nobody ever spent Christmas Day in jail who was in there for moonshining. They let them go home. And
so that was a lesser crime then.
Right. They knew they'd come back. They'd come back right after Christmas and serve the rest of their time. But old man Lud and old man Joe would let them out. They were really honorable people. They didn't mean any harm. Of course, it got to be kind of rough later on because there's so much hijacking went on. And people got jealous of each other. And it wasn't anything to have a shootout with the moonshiners and people hauling whiskey. People come in and try to hijack them. And a number of cases happened like that. In fact, there was one big shootout I heard about. A fellow named Rod Mattingly told me about being involved in hauling liquor over in Marion County, close to Dan Station area, really. And I don't think anybody really got killed, but they had a real shootout over the thing.
Pretty vicious sounding.
Yeah, it's a dog-eat-dog thing, I guess, after a while. And of course, really, moonshining continued clear on up for a considerable period of time, and it's just been in very recent years that I knew moonshiners who operated up in the late 50s. And but I haven't heard of any around here since. Most of the problems with, in fact, while I was at Maker's Mark, we had three different break-ins where the people went in two cases they stole barrels out of the warehouse, but in another case, they emptied the contents right in the warehouse and siphoned the whiskey out. And I think more of the illicit operations were involved with the legal distilleries, where they would either steal whiskey from the distilleries, from a warehouse or bottling houses, or case storage rooms, than there was in actual making the moonshine. Although back in the 50s, I was associated with some people down in Harlan County and Bell County, and I know a lot of operations were going on down there then. Because I still have a bottle of moonshine that was, I put a date on it, it was 1961, I think, that I picked up at just for souvenir. The biggest problem with moonshine, of course, was that it was a product that they were making very fast, and there was no sanitation involved. There was a lot of lead involved in the construction of the equipment, and a lot of it was poisonous. There's no question about it. And in some cases, they adulterated their product. They'd add materials to it that were definitely not good for your system. And in fact, I've heard so many cases where there's a possibility that even wood alcohol was introduced into it, and wood alcohol will make you go blind. That's methyl alcohol, and it's very, very dangerous. That's like a lot of your products on the market today. A lot of painters sometimes get to the point where they'll drink just about anything. They drink paint thinner, which is mostly methyl alcohol. And I think it probably, as long as people are going to drink, the greatest thing is to have it legalized, because there is less danger. There's no question about the fact that whiskey is, if you could outlaw whiskey completely, I doubt it very seriously if fermented distillers would oppose it. If you could get rid of it completely now. But if you're going to have illegal operations, it's far better to have it legalized.
Mm-hmm. Is that one reason you feel like Prohibition was a failure?
I think so. You see, Prohibition not only ushered in your gangster element, but it was a dangerous product. We probably had more crime during the Roaring Twenties than any other period in the history of our country. You look at the 10 most wanted men on the FBI list back in the 20s, and you'll find that they're wanted for more heinous crimes than any of the 10 most wanted men you see today. Now, you may find somebody that's guilty of maybe killing a man or robbing banks and that sort of thing, but back during the 20s, then you had Machine Gun Kelly and Al Capone and Ramos, as I mentioned, Dillinger came in that period, Babyface Nelson, a bunch of those real hardened criminals. They were guilty not killing one man, but many, many men. And they had no conscience. They'd do anything. So I think that settled the country down considerably by repealing the 18th Amendment. I think it made the country a little more law-abiding. Mm-hmm. At least it did in this area.
Sounds like people became a little more civil, doesn't it?
I think so. Of course, it's about like when the West was won. A lot of the early pioneers of the West took their women along, but in a lot of cases, why they went without their women, and you know what happened as far as the towns that sprung up with the saloons and their brothels, and it wasn't until they brought their women in and women were able to control their men to some extent and make them cut out all that whiskey drinking and fooling around with all those women, and they set up schools and churches to kind of take the barbarian out of their men folks.
Sounds good for us, doesn't it, Gene?
Guess it works.
Well, Mr. Cecil, it's been a very enlightening morning. Are there any other thoughts that you want to let us know, or got any other feelings? If not, we'll just sum this thing up.
Mary, I think I've pretty well exhausted what little I know about it. I do have a lot of reference books. I've got quite a collection of whiskey books, books written about the industry. In fact, I've collaborated with a number of people who have written books. One of the most notable of these is Bell's Bluegrass and Bourbon, written by Harry Harrison Kroll, and I worked with him for about 2 weeks in compiling the information that he put in his book. In fact, I didn't know until just recently that he was one of Jesse Stewart's teachers at the old Lincoln Institute, and he wrote quite a remarkable book, but I've got a large number of books of. In fact, every time I find a book on the whiskey industry, I pick it up. I've got a couple of copies of Red Liquor that Irvin Cobb wrote. And I have some photostated copies of some books that were in the University of Kentucky Library that date back in the 1600s. But I do have another book that I think is, even though it's fiction, it was largely based on fact. And it's based around the period of 1792 when Alexander Hamilton, who was Secretary of State or Secretary of Treasury under George Washington, enacted the first federal tax on whiskey and began the Whiskey Rebellion. And this book was called Amber Fire, and it's quite a well-written book, and I happen to have a copy of that, and it's probably a very rare book now. I doubt if you could ever find another copy of it. But that's about all I have. I do like to read up on different things, and as I say, I've collected articles and different publications on the industry, and it's about all I know is the whiskey business, mm-hmm. and I think I do know a little bit about it, and I do like to talk about it. Mm-hmm. It's since I spent so many years in it, I felt like that was my whole life. I appreciate you coming out, Mary. It's been very pleasant. Enjoyed discussing it with you, and if there's any further help I can give you, I'll be glad to.
Thank you again. And thank you, Gene, for your wonderful hospitality and for sitting in here. And we certainly appreciate this.